Good morning. I think at this point in time I say Anthony.
Yes, sir, open. We have you connected.
Are you there, Anthony?
Yes, sir, we have you connected.
We're ready to start the meeting.
Thank you, sir.
Open the phones. Thank you. Anthony, are we good to go?
Yes, sir, you're connected.
Okay, thank you. Okay, welcome everybody. I'm Peter Crooks. It's been my honor to chair this process now a couple of times, third time, and, you know, third time's a charm, then I think hopefully this time we'll get it right, because it's always challenging and fun. But on behalf of myself and my co-chair, Kristen Schonder, who can't be here today, she will be calling in this morning. Welcome. And thank you all for being here and for participating in this important work. And I'm going to try to keep my comments short and so we can get busy. I just wanted to say a couple things about that I think we've all been talking about this morning, the new and improved NQF evaluation process for steering committees. And, you know, what I think it's really saying to me is the process is evolving. Those of us who were here 3 years ago and then in January and now once again, we've been able to see the process is tightening up and more is expected from measure developers and more in the way, of course, of validity and reliability. And I think in the long run, that's a good thing. But as I told Karen Wiesett, that this committee is always the pilot case. I don't know. That's been our good fortune before. But importance has been better defined. Impact, does it have high impact or not? That's really very important. Is there a gap in care? What does the evidence say? Does it really support it or not? And some guidance. I think it's very helpful on how to rate the evidence and whether it supports the metric. And then what I think is the biggest challenge is coming to grips with reliability and more difficult validity. I'm sure we'll be talking about that to some extent as we try to apply these new criteria. And now it's actually a stop criteria. If it's not valid, we can't accept it. So that's going to be the challenge, I think, for this group today. And hopefully we can help the NQF figure out how to keep improving the process through this. So a few announcements. First of all, remember the meeting is open to the public, and it is being audio taped, and please use your microphones. I don't think the request function works on these, so just have to raise your hand, and Karen and Lauren will help me see the field. If I'm involved over here, I might not see you over here, but we'll try to scan the deck. What else? The schedule, you know, I think is known to all of you. Today we're starting at 9. Tomorrow we'll start an hour earlier. Breakfast will start at 7:30. We're going to try and be done by 3 or 3:15 so we can catch those 5:30 flights from Dulles. And, well, speaking personally, we have several new committee members, and Lorian Dalrymple is going to be calling in, I guess because of pregnancy. She's had a baby, so she'll be able to call and participate a little later. Oh, you're on? Hi, Lorian.
Morning.
So, Lorian, we'll be asking you to introduce yourself a little bit later, along with Dr. Andrew Feves, Michael Fisher, Stephen McMurray, Michael Somers, and Jana Welch. And thank you all for volunteering to participate. You didn't know what you were getting into, but you'll find out pretty fast. Christina, you on?
I think she's going to call in.
She'll be calling later. Okay. I'd also like to welcome the measure stewards and developers who are with us today. And I won't go through the list. We have, in the past, you may recall, we've had two or three developers of our metrics. Now we're up to 7. So, and they will all be introducing themselves a bit in turn as their metrics come up. Okay, so I think at this point I can turn it over to Helen for her greeting. Are you ready to greet?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome again. Welcome back. More renal. Again, want to thank you for coming back and participating one more time. And again, want to thank you as well for helping us as we move through our new processes. We hope they add clarity, but I think as we've been learning through the first several steering committees who've used the new criteria, you'll be, I think, relying fairly heavily on Karen to help interpret some of that. We did put together a small cheat sheet that we're, can we pass it out yet? Okay. That we'll pass out. That's just very simply reviews each of the criteria and the ratings that'll be associated when you're asked to vote. Just to kind of keep it very simple. Please let us know if this is useful. We literally just put it together. We just thought it might be nice to have a very simple. Karen and I initially kept talking about the imaginary one pager. It doesn't go on one page. It doesn't go on one page, but it is two-sided double. You know, two backs and back, back to back, two pages. So we hope this is useful. It also explains exactly where the stop sequences are now. So the last time that importance to measure and report was a must-pass criterion, and if it didn't pass that, particularly about gaps in the gap or especially any of the issues around evidence, we stopped evaluating the measure. An important new feature of the work that the task force has been also passed by the board as well is that now we also have a stop after scientific acceptability. So if the measure is not reliable and valid with precise specifications, it doesn't really matter if it's usable or feasible either. So we've added that to the hierarchy. So I think it'll be a slightly different process today. We can distribute these. The only thing I'll mention is also our general counsel, Ann Hammersmith, on vacation this week. So I'm happy to just give you the brief intro to disclosures. So as you're doing the introductions this morning, please disclose anything you think is important for your fellow committee members to know about. We don't need you to recite your CVs. We all have read them. They're voluminous. But really indicate areas particularly where you think there might be conflicts with any of the measures. And at the end, we'll ask you to... If you have any questions for each other as we go through this process. So with that, I'll turn it back to Peter and we can run the table.
Okay, thank you, Helen. I think we're ready to do introductions
mm-hmm.
now. Okay. So I will start out with an exemplary introduction, I hope. Behind us is the few points we'd like you to touch on today. Just one non-medical interest to sort of broaden out our view of you. So I will start out. My name is Peter Crooks. I'm with Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. I live in Los Angeles and have survived an earthquake and a lot of other natural disasters over the years. I have been involved in quality since the early 90s when we began to develop our quality program at Kaiser Permanente and have been fortunate enough to be involved with the KDOQI committee, steering committee, several companies that were evolved with Kaiser and Fresenius to bring quality to the marketplace and now with the National Quality Forum. So my main non-medical interest is music as a composer and a performer, and I didn't bring any tapes today, I'm sorry to say, but I will next time if there is a next time. And on to my disclosures. Have I had any direct relationship with any organization of the types listed in the disclosure of interest policy? I am on the board of directors of the California Dialysis Council, which is a political action committee informing the legislature about the needs of dialysis patients and dialysis industry. As a partner at Kaiser Permanente, I do help develop quality metrics, but nothing has been submitted this go-around, and nothing really directly competing. My partners serve as medical directors in numerous Fresenius medical care facilities, as well as one DaVita facility and one Renal Advantage facility. So I think that's about it for me. Okay, shall we just move around to the right? Okay, Janet.
My name's Janet Welch. I'm a professor of nursing at Indiana University School of Nursing in Indianapolis. And my area of research interest is self-management of diet and fluid limitations by hemodialysis patients. And I would say a non-medical interest is probably crafting. The only disclosure I had listed was that I'm the chair of the membership committee for the Midwest Nursing Research Society.
Thank you.
Good morning. Jesse Pavlenak, from Portland, Oregon. I'm the director of inpatient clinical and nutrition at Oregon Health and Sciences University Hospitals and Clinics. My quality interest and experience, I was chair of the chronic kidney disease evidence analysis process for the American Dietetic Association a couple of years, and have worked in other quality areas. My non-medical interest, I am a charter member of the One More Time Around Again marching band, so I still, since Peter started out with a music gig, and an alumni marcher for Oregon State University. Disclosure, I'm the current vice chair for the Northwest Renal Medical Review Board up in Seattle. How are you, Connie? And I've been members of the Oregon and National Kidney Foundation Council on Renal Nutrition.
I'm Michael Summers. I'm a pediatric nephrologist from Children's Hospital in Boston, where I'm the director of clinical service and help direct the dialysis unit as well. Several years ago, I got a phone call from someone in the hospital asking me if I'd like to be involved with something called quality, and that's how I first began to have an interest in this realm, and I've been involved at Children's and helping to formulate quality plans for our division and portions of the hospital as a whole. In terms of my non-medical interests, I like to kayak. I also like to do trivia. And actually, I like to kayak doing trivia with a couple of people. So I know that's more than one, but it combines things together. In terms of disclosures, I'm a member of an advisory board for Novartis, and I'm also the treasurer on the board of directors for the ESRD network in New England.
My name is Michael Fisher. I'm a clinical nephrologist at the University of Illinois in the Department of Veterans Affairs in Chicago. I became involved in this because the VA had asked me to come and kind of be the VA representative, as we've recently formed a chronic kidney disease working group looking at developing performance measures within the Department of Veterans Affairs and capitalizing on the VA electronic information system. My non-medical interests, big tennis fan, hope to get all four of the Grand Slams one day, two down, two to go. I think my conflicts of interest, I have the customary society memberships and other than the VA working group, which we just kind of have started. I don't think it's in any competition with this organization.
Good morning. I'm Lisa Latt. I'm Vice President for Public Health Policy with WellPoint, which is a large national health insurer. I am an internist, have a subspecialty in medical complications of pregnancy, and I'll tell you, when you assigned me the measures that involve the parathyroid calcium phosphorus axis, I was like, oh my God. thanks. Appreciate that, Karen. I have been in charge of quality for some time with WellPoint, although now am more on the public health sector, working on our public health programs. Live in Denver, Colorado, and non-work interest, my hobby is travel, ideally overseas and as exotic as possible, although having 21-month-old twins means that I don't get to do it very much. In terms of other thing I should add for quality interest is that I'm also a renal patient, having developed HUS after I delivered my twins on ESRD and dialysis for about 10 months, and now I'm about 10 months post-kidney transplant. So, and then only other disclosure is that I work for WellPoint, obviously.
Good morning. I'm Joe Nally. I'm the director of the Center for Chronic Kidney Disease at the Cleveland Clinic. Which makes me a Clevelander, some good, some bad. My interest in quality relates back to the original KDOKI days, where I've been part of that effort since 2002. I'm currently the Vice Chair of Public Policy KDOKI for NKF. In terms of other interest and disclosures, I'm the PI at the clinic for our CKD registry of over 60,000 CKD patients. That was originally started with an unrestricted grant from Amgen and now Genzyme. Non-medical interest. What can you say after Lisa's non-medical interest? I'm simply a golfer, a racquetball player, and support the travel of my children.
Good morning. I'm Jerry Jackson from Birmingham, Alabama. I'm a practicing nephrologist there. I'm involved a great deal with interventional nephrology, and also I'm the medical director of two Fresenius dialysis clinics. I've been involved with Network 8 for over 15 years and chairman of the medical review board there. Got involved in quality management, quality interest, largely through that. I've been on the network forum, serve on the Quality, Safety, and Accountability Subcommittee of Renal Physicians Association. As far as outside interests, primarily right now, grandchildren, we have four, and also photography and gardening.
Hi, I'm Rick Keskell, pediatric nephrologist at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore of Albert Einstein, vice chair and director of pediatric nephrology and child health. Had some research interests in glomerular disease, progression, and chronic kidney disease in children. I've also worked with Andy Narver on the NKDEP program and was on the New York ESRD network. I have only disclosures from some NIH support and outside interests of my family, and I like to sail.
Good morning, Jeff Burns from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I am here as a representative from the American Society of Nephrology. I've been involved, as is Joe, in KDOKI, actually when it was DOKI, then KDOKI, and I'm vice chair for practice guidelines and commentaries for the NKF. Disclosures, I have been involved as an advisor for clinical trials for Amgen, which is not an active endeavor, and I think that's the only disclosure at this time. Non-medical interests, I'm training for the New York Marathon.
Good morning. My name is Andrew Finvis. I'm from Dallas. I'm an adult nephrologist. I represent Baylor Healthcare Systems. I'm a chief of the division of nephrology there. I got involved because my institution is doing a lot of new safety and quality review, and I wanted me to get involved. Obviously, I'm from Dallas. My outside interest, according to my wife, I'm addicted to duplicate bridge, which is true, but I only get to play online, occasionally in person. And my disclosures, a grant support from the Baylor Cancer Center and the NIH, and I'm co-editor for a few more months of Dialysis and Transplantation, which unfortunately is closing in October. So.
I'm Alan Kleiger. I'm a nephrologist in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm the chief medical officer and chief quality officer for the Hospital of St. Raphael's in New Haven. My quality interest really started, I was on the steering committee of the original DOKI, which then became KDOKI, and have been involved with quality since then, and served as the chair of the RPA's Quality, Safety, and Accountability Committee. Non-medical interest, I sing. I sang with the New Haven Chorale in Europe this summer, which was wonderful. And in terms of interest disclosures, I also have some support from the NIH and some support from investigator-directed research from Amgen, and I'm a member of the board of directors of the Renal Physicians Association.
Ruben Velez. I'm a nephrologist in Dallas. Been there for 30-something years from coming originally from Puerto Rico, so you can feel my Texan accent here. I'm still practicing. One day I'll get it. But anyway, medical director of Fresenius Facilities, clinical mostly. My main disclosure would be president of the Renal Physician Association. Really no other conflict of interest at this time. Outside medicine, I definitely love sailing and scuba diving, which I was able to do with my family after trying to get them together. So I'm trying to spend more time with the family, and that's a project by itself. So.
Hi, I'm Steve McMurray. I'm a nephrologist. Live in Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm a VP of Clinical Integrated Care Management Services for DaVita. My interest in quality was on the review board of Network 9 and 10 for about 20 years and served there and was on the Renal Physicians Association and developed health work on some of the quality measures during that time. My interest, I like to play golf, like to collect contemporary art. Those are the two things that keep me going during the rest of the days. I think my only disclosure is that I do work for DaVita.
Hi, I'm Myra Kleinfeder. I'm a nephrologist from Tulane in New Orleans. I got involved in quality originally as director of the outpatient clinics at Charity Hospital in New Orleans before Katrina and did a lot of the projects related to ambulatory care. And since things changed, I now do primarily nephrology and have been involved in the Network 13 Quality Improvement Committee. My disclosures, I'm on the Speaker's Bureau for Pfizer, Gilead, Glaxo, Boehringer, and some things coming up soon with Amgen. In terms of my non-medical interests, I like to travel, but this summer it's been hot everywhere I've gone, so we'll try the winter this year and see if we can get a little bit better travel things done. And that's it. Thank you.
I'm Connie Anderson from the Northwest Kidney Centers in Seattle. I am responsible as the Vice President of Clinical Operations for the quality programs at the Northwest Kidney Centers. I also staff the Quality Committee of the Board of Trustees that oversees all of our quality programs. So I've been embedded and passionate about quality for many, many years. I also serve on the Quality Committee of the National Renal Administrators Association and with KCP, the Kidney Care Partners. In terms of my non-medical interests, well, my passion is snow skiing, but just recently I had the opportunity to perform on stage in Guys and Dolls, so I think I may change my passion. It was a great experience. In terms of disclosures, I don't think I have any.
My name is Bobby Wazer. I'm a nephrology nurse, a treatment option specialist in San Antonio, Texas. My disclosures, I work with Fresenius Medical Care. I've been a patient advocate for about 30-some years since my first transplant. I am a two-time transplant recipient and was on hemodialysis. Non-medical interests, my husband and son, and I have four beautiful Scottish Terriers, so it doesn't matter which order. Sometimes the dogs come first. I'm sorry, they do. I'm an avid Illinois fan, football, University, Go Illini, and avid Washington Redskins fan. So I love sports. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Kathy LeBeau, and I work with, I'm the patient advocacy project manager for the Renal Support Network, a national patient group run by patients. I am, my interest in quality, frankly, is self-interest and that of my fellow patients, because I'm a home hemodialysis patient, past 4 years, three years now, and a waiting transplant candidate. I did I mention I'm from Albany, New York? Yeah. My non-medical interest, well, most of you who are here in January know that although I'm a very serious patient advocate, I am a professional clown part-time. I play symphonic kazoo, so I'm very interested in sharing that with the folks who have musical interest in the room. My disclosures, I participate in a number of renal coalitions and committees, UNOS and the ESRD Network of New York, and I think that's everything.
My name's Harvey Wells. I have no position, nor am I organized. Mid-Cities area in between Dallas and Fort Worth. My interest in quality is I, too, am a patient. I found out I had some renal insufficiency when I was 18, and I tried to join the Navy. And other than that, I had no outward signs, so I was classified 4F. And I really did nothing about it till my mid-40s when I went to a nephrologist because of high blood pressure. My doctor wanted me to have a biopsy done, and I found out that I was going to be on dialysis within 6 months. I was able to put it off for 4 years, changing some practices of mine and what have you, but eventually I was on dialysis for 6 months. My wife donated her kidney, and it lasted 8 years. She wouldn't give me the other one. I went back on dialysis for 5.5 years, and I thought that's how my life was going to end, but fortunately, since we've been together last, I had a transplant in March at Baylor University in Dallas, and it's working great, and my life has changed again. So my interest in quality, I found out then a lot of things about dialysis and kidney care, and over the last 4 years, I spent a lot of time traveling to dialysis centers and talking to patients and just getting their perspective, and I've tried to encourage more dialysis patients to consider home options because I feel that they deliver a better quality of care. They're able to help you to live your life like you had originally wanted to, and it certainly did me. My non-medical interest, I love to travel, and I have 4 grandchildren that I love spending time with. And originally when I started traveling for Next Stage Medical, I thought it was going to be the latter part of my life. I told somebody I just didn't realize it might be the longest chapter of my life. And I spent a lot of time traveling with my grandchildren and visiting different places. I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, a suffering Cleveland Browns fan. And 1 year I actually was able to attend all their games home and away. The only disclosure I have is I am paid by Next Stage when I represent them at the centers, and I appreciate being here.
Lorian? Yeah. Lorian, please go ahead.
Okay. My name is Lorian Dalrymple. I'm a nephrologist at UC Davis. I spend the majority of my time doing clinical research. I'm an epidemiologist, and my non-clinical interest, I would say, is cooking, but my husband would probably disagree. I cook about once every 6 months now, and as mentioned, I have a 12-day-old son and a 2-year-old daughter, so I'm sorry I couldn't join you in person. The only disclosure I have is that one of the sources of research funding I receive is from Dialysis Clinics Incorporated.
Okay, thank you. Andrew Narva will be joining us, I understand, in a bit. He's coming, but was delayed. And is Christine on now? Are you on, Christine? Okay. So,
hi, everyone. I'm Lauren Ritchie, the project manager, now on my second tour of renal duty. I'd like to thank everyone for coming again, and to the new members, thank you, and thank you for putting up with my slew of emails over the last few months.
And I'm Karen Pace. I'm a senior program director at NQF, and again, I also would like to thank you for all your hard work and preparation for this meeting. And we have one other staff person here, Tanae Davenport, who will be helping us with the electronic voting today. So I guess with that, we can get into our program. Oh, we need to ask if anyone has any
Briefly, based on what you've heard, does anybody have any questions of each other about your disclosures? Anything you'd like to bring up or raise? Yes, please.
I have one minor disclosure to add that hit me as I was listening to other people. I also have some NIH support on a grant on studying racial disparities in CKD care. Okay, any other comments or questions for each other? Okay, I think it's time then for, and we're doing well, we're on time. So for Karen and Lauren to...
Hello? Sorry, it's Lorian. Received NIH funding and research funding from UC Davis Clinical and Translational Science Center. I don't think it's relevant to this. I just wanted to add that
tonight.
Okay, thank you. Any other last-minute disclosures? Come clean now. Okay, I'll turn it over to Karen and Lauren to review our project and kick us off today.
Okay, Karen and I are going to start with an overview of the project, and then Karen will go into a little bit deeper details as far as the actual measure criteria and evaluation process. So most of you were on the orientation call, so we'll keep this introduction very brief. Just as a reminder, the purpose of this project is to, again, identify and endorse renal-related measures for public reporting and quality improvement. And a little bit different from the previous project in that we are also looking at currently endorsed measures for maintaining their endorsement status. We will seek to, this project, different from the last project as well, which was specific to ESRD. This project now includes CKD and ESRD, although we did include a call for other renal-related conditions. We did not receive any measures, so again, primarily CKD and ESRD. Again, the steering committee is asked to act as a proxy for our multi-stakeholder membership, work with us here at NQF to achieve the goals of the project, evaluate the submitted measures against our criteria, which we know is a little bit different from the last time, and then to make recommendations to the NQF membership for endorsement, and as well as respond to comments received on the measures once they go out for comment for our public and NQF members. Again, this is just a visual schematic of our consensus development process, or our CDP as we like to refer to it. There you can see the project steering committee's role, followed by drafting recommendations, and so forth. Again, the objectives for today's meeting is to, we will spend the better part of today and tomorrow evaluating the measures against the new criteria. And then tomorrow we will get into evaluating measures for related and competing measures, as well as identify gaps in performance measures. So just a high-level overview of the measures that we have, 34 in total, with the bulk of them being around anemia, cardiovascular, dialysis adequacy, mineral metabolism, and vascular access. We do have one mortality measure, and a combination of patient education and quality of life measures. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Karen for our measure evaluation criteria.
Okay, I just wanted to review a few things. We talked about some of this on the orientation call and then on our optional call, and had talked with Peter last week, and he suggested that I spend a little time trying to get us all on the same page specifically about reliability and validity, but I'll also touch on some of the recommendations from the task force about evidence. So just to try to get us started out on the same page, and then we'll work through the individual measures. Okay, you want to go to the... So one of the things that... one of the things that Lauren mentioned is that in this project we'll be looking at both new measures and endorsed measures. So I wanted to just kind of explain that In our process now, endorsed measures are required to meet the same criteria, the current criteria that new measures would be. So even though, you know, the endorsed measures were endorsed in 2007 or later, as Peter mentioned, our criteria and guidance of mainly guidance on how we apply the criteria has evolved over the years, and measures, whether they're endorsed or new, are expected to meet the criteria that are current at that point in time. There are a few things that we try to focus on maybe a little bit differently with the endorsed measures, and the first one is that hopefully an endorsed measure has been implemented, and if so, we'd like to actually see data from that implementation. So, for example, with opportunity for improvement, if it's a new measure, they might submit something from the literature about how that particular focus of measurement is or is not being implemented, or where the performance gap is. If it's a measure that's been implemented, we'd like to see what the data are for that measure. How are the facilities or physicians doing on that measure? One of the things, as you know, with opportunity for improvement, it's under our importance to measure and report, and it if under the new guidance, all three of the sub-criteria must be met. One of the things, and I'll go into it a little more detail in just a moment, is about a potential for reserve status. If a measure has a high level of performance, and this would only be for an already endorsed measure, if when it comes back it has a high level of performance, typically that would not meet our criteria of opportunity for improvement, but we've implemented a process where in exceptional circumstances, we can endorse the measure in reserve status, meaning it's a highly credible, reliable, evidence-based measure currently with high levels of performance, and we would endorse it kind of if it's needed to be used. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The other thing is that reliability and validity for an endorsed measure. The goal is hopefully that there's been some expansion of that testing unless it's already at the high rating, but that's something that we'll take a look at as we get into the individual measures. Usability for an endorsed measure, again, we'd actually like to get some information about use of the measure. Typically, an endorsed measure, when it comes back for endorsement maintenance, has been endorsed for up to 3 years, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, and so we'd like some information on how it's actually being used. And then feasibility, certainly if there's been any unintended consequences as a result of implementing a measure. Okay, next slide. So you know that our rating scale is high, moderate, low, and then insufficient, or insufficient evidence. For some of the criteria, we have a generic rating scale, and then for evidence, reliability, and validity, there's very specific definitions for what constitutes high, moderate, and low. Okay. The other thing, next, yes. We've had some questions, and we just want to clarify the difference between a low rating and insufficient evidence or insufficient information. And basically, a low rating generally means that the evidence or information demonstrates that the criterion is not met, whereas insufficient evidence or insufficient information means the evidence does not exist or nothing was submitted or inadequate information was submitted. We like to keep that distinction that low means it really, that whatever was submitted demonstrates it was not met versus insufficient to make that determination. If the reason for the insufficient rating is because the measure developer didn't submit something, that can be, of course, remedied versus if it just doesn't exist. Okay, next one. So
then that brings us to the question of how to deal with measure submissions that may have been inadequate versus the evidence just doesn't exist. And I know that this has come up on some of the discussions and questions and our optional call. So what we had suggested on your preliminary evaluations is that if the evidence, you know, information was not sufficient, the evidence wasn't provided, to go ahead and rate that as insufficient, but to make a note that you know that there's evidence that supports it or information or data that supports that particular criterion. When we discussed the measures and after the committee's discussion, if the committee is really confident that that evidence does exist, you can rate the evidence based on your agreed understanding of the evidence, and we could ask the measure developer to update their submission with that evidence that does exist. So, and we could make the recommendation provisional on having that additional evidence. It's a kind of a fine line, and we'll certainly rely on your expertise and judgment and assistance with this. But what we're hearing is that sometimes the measure submission may not totally represent the evidence that exists, and so we do really rely on your knowledge and expertise. But as you all know, assimilating a body of evidence and grading it is a big project in and of itself. So it's not something we expect you to do on the fly, but certainly many of you have been very intimately involved in evidence reviews and have knowledge of what has been assembled. Okay, next one. So importance to measure and report. As we've mentioned, this is a must-pass criterion, and the recent guidance is that all three sub-criteria must be met. This includes high-impact aspect of healthcare, and this generally involves, you know, it involves a large number of patients, high resource use, high consequences of or severity of consequences of poor quality. The next one is gap in performance or opportunity for improvement. And in this one, we are asking for data about variability in performance or overall poor performance. That could be a situation where it's not really much variability, but it's just being done poorly across the board. And then the last one is evidence supports the measure focus. Particular health outcomes have an exception to having to present a body of evidence, but certainly a process measure, a structure measure, other types of measures should have an evidence base that says that's an effective intervention, service, treatment to warrant having a performance measure. So I think this was an area that we had a lot of discussion at our last meeting. And to really make the distinction that what we're talking about here is importance to measure and report, meaning it's important to have a performance measure that hopefully will be publicly reported at some point, versus everything that's important to do in day-to-day practice of renal patients. So I know that this will come up in some of the measures that that we're going to be reviewing today, but just wanted to, again, make that point that, you know, there are thousands of things that are important to do in practice of care. They don't all need to have a performance measure, and I'm sure we'll have some discussion about that as we go through the measures. Yes.
I'd just like to interject a quick question. I think it's appropriate that as we're going through this process, when we're getting to the evidence supports measure focus, there's a question, is this a health outcome or not, or I guess a process? And then it says, if it's a process, then you apply that chart with the body of evidence. But if it's a health outcome, you don't. Is that
right?
Right.
So that's a good point, and I think we've had this, it's been a little confusing, but basically, if it's a health outcome and there's a rationale for its relationship to healthcare services, then
the developer does not have to present a body of evidence to support it because it's a health outcome. And there could be multiple bodies of evidence that relate to that health outcome. However, if they do submit a body of evidence, I mean, that strengthens the application and the strengthens the interest in that particular outcome, and we would ask you to at least rate it since they went to the trouble of providing that additional information. So when we go through individual measures, we'll kind of skip that question about health outcome. Is there a rationale? If it's not a health outcome, we don't need to talk about that particularly.
Well, we could save some time, though, if it's really a health outcome, and it's why should we review the evidence in this setting if we're going to be pressed for time?
Okay.
One other comment. The other thing that seems clear but sometimes be fuzzy, what's a process and what's an outcome? You know, because some seem to could be both. You know, it's an inner or it's intermediate somewhere. And how do you can make a
right.
clear distinction there?
That's sometimes quite difficult. Health outcomes tend to be end result, you know, obviously mortality, or some things that actually are proxies for health outcomes, such as readmission. Intermediate clinical outcomes tend to be more the things related to clinical parameters, such as the hemoglobin value, a, you know, lab value of some sort, the blood pressure level. And then process generally is some type of treatment, service, intervention. But sometimes it's you know, based on perspective.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for some things it's much more clear and others not. But the exception for presenting a body of evidence is really just for the health outcome, not for intermediate clinical outcomes. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. So next slide, opportunity for improvement. So as I said, we're looking for variability or overall poor performance, and this is where I'm going to talk about potential reserve status for endorsed measures that have demonstrated high levels of performance. And actually, I think the first measure we get into is one that fits that category. And the reason for implementing this reserve status is to retain endorsement of reliable and valid quality performance measures that have overall high levels of performance so that, you know, the measure could be used in the future if necessary. This is intended to be for an exceptional circumstance, not the rule for every, you know, endorsed measure. And there are certain criteria that would apply. And one of the things that we really want to focus on is high levels of performance that are actually due to quality improvement and actions to improve care versus problems with the measure, you know, so that I guess the best example of the distinction I'm thinking of is in the past we had some measures about smoking cessation counseling. And the measure could be fulfilled, and people were concerned about it turning into kind of a checkbox type of measure so that there were really high levels of performance, but most people thought it was really related to documentation versus any real change in care. So, you know, we'll have to work through that, but the idea is that the high levels of performance improvement hopefully are really demonstrating that people have actually improved and are doing well with that particular aspect of care. Okay, so the next slide then is the criteria for reserve status. When we are looking at opportunity for our performance gap or opportunity for improvement and the data that are submitted, we need you to kind of discern, you know, the distribution of the performance scores. How many entities and patients does that include? So if it's a very small sample, then maybe it's not really representative of what's really going on in the field. data on disparities, if they provided data on disparities, so the overall scores could look fairly good, but if you start getting looking at disparities, there may still be opportunities for improvement in terms of disparities in care. Again, size of the population at risk, effectiveness of the intervention. So all of these things need to be factored in, first of all, to your consideration of whether there's really high performance. And then the additional criteria that need to be met. And so the point we're bringing up is that typically if a measure doesn't have an opportunity for improvement, it won't pass importance to measure and report. It will stop at that point if it's an endorsed measure and see if you think it's something that would need to be considered for reserve status, and we will continue the evaluation. Lisa, you have a question?
Yeah, when you say data on disparities, do you mean that there's data, that there are no disparities within that measure? So if,
right.
Even if performance is high overall, but there's evidence that there's a disparity, we would not keep it. We would
right.
Not put it on reserve.
Exactly. Okay. So next. So in addition to those considerations, criteria for reserve status is it would be measures that have strong direct evidence of a link to desired health outcomes. Basically, we would want this for measures that are measuring things that are proximal to the desired outcome. So that those two first bullet points lead us to generally measures that are more distal to the desired outcome would not be eligible for reserve status. The reliability and validity ratings, our guidance is that they should be at the high rating. It may be too soon to be that stringent there, but we'll have a discussion about that. And again, as I mentioned, the reason for the high levels of performance is actually better performance. And that we hope to see demonstrated usefulness for improving quality and demonstrated use of the measure. Okay.
Karen, can I
yes.
ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Can you go back and talk a little bit about disparities again?
Yes.
So when you're talking about disparities, I think what I heard was the distinction between disparities in care versus disparities found within the measure. Is that what I heard?
Right. So, for example, if we're talking about a measure of some care process, and if you look at the scores across the facilities, it looks like there's a fairly high level of performance across all facilities. But if you looked at that data in terms of differences between races, whether they get that particular process or service, that you may see some gaps there that didn't show up in the kind of higher level analysis. So that's what we're getting at there. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Okay. So the next, we wanted to talk a little bit about the evidence guidance. And some of the key points here from the task force were they really wanted developers to submit information so that the evidence that does or does not exist to support a performance measure is transparent to steering committee, the public who review these measures, ultimately the NQF membership that votes on them. And the requirements are the request for information about evidence is probably the biggest change in our measure submission form. Because the task force really wanted to get information about the quantity, the quality, and the consistency of the body of evidence. The measure developers, the other key point is that the task force guidance was not that measure developers should be conducting primary evidence reviews. Obviously, that's a whole big endeavor in itself, but hopefully should use existing evidence reviews that have been systematically assembled and graded. The task force identified that preferred evidence grading systems were U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and GRADE, but recognize that in today's current environment, there are others or modifications, and so those are acceptable. We ask if which system they're using, and if it's other, that's fine to say other, but to describe that. Expert opinion is not considered evidence, and we already talked about the exception for health outcomes, and obviously, you know, there's no kind of cut and dried way to do this. We still rely on the expertise and judgment of the steering committee. Yes.
With some measures that may be more novel and there isn't a reviews or body of evidence, then was it expected that there would be more of a literature review of individual studies, or is that not what was expected?
Well, it's a good question, and I guess the answer would be yes if there wasn't any kind of body of evidence review that was existing to you know, provide what evidence there was, and then the steering committee would have to weigh that, and we'll get into that to a certain extent. And, you know, as we go through this, you know, the experience that we're having with the steering committees as we're kind of trying to implement this task force guidance, you know, we'll try to have some debrief time at the end of our day tomorrow so that we can get some of your feedback of what's working and what's not and where we need to think about going back to the task force and making some revisions to that. Okay, so quantity, quality, and consistency of the body of evidence, and you know that there's with specific rating scales describing these in the high, moderate, low, or insufficient evidence. And quantity is simply how many studies in the body of evidence. Quality is about the certainty or confidence in the estimates of benefits and harms to patients across studies in the body of evidence. And there's a description of what kinds of things are considered here, certainly the study design, flaws in the study, those kinds of things, directness of evidence. And then consistency has to do with both the direction and magnitude of effects across the body of studies. Okay, next slide. And so we have two exceptions to this. We've already talked about health outcomes, and we really just need to see that there's a rationale for connection between the health outcome and at least one structure, process, service, intervention of healthcare. And then there is one, another exception, potential exception, if there really is not a body of evidence and about expert opinion. And we'll try to address that once we review the body of evidence. And if something is not going to pass because of evidence, if the steering committee thinks that it's something that should continue to go forward based on expert opinion, we'll have a discussion about that. I think one of the things that we're going to ask you to do, as we did last time, is that we really need to try to ground your recommendations in the criteria. And if something doesn't meet criteria, but there's a reason for potentially continuing on with the recommendation, we have to have that well documented for our reviewers and ultimately for our Consensus Standards Approval Committee and the board, because they're really looking to see why measures that may appear not to meet our criteria are being recommended. Okay. All right. So let's talk about scientific acceptability of measure properties. Basically, this comes down to reliability and validity. Reliability includes both precise specifications. And generally, if that's the problem, that can be remedied by going back to the developer and asking that they define something or provide more specification. But we do expect reliability testing to demonstrate reliability at either the level of the data elements that are used in constructing the measure or at the precision of the performance measure score, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Validity. starts with, is the measure consistent with the evidence that was provided in support of the measure? And then validity testing. And then finally, if there are potential threats to validity, has an analysis been done to really demonstrate that those are resolved or not a problem? So this is an issue if it's an outcome measure, risk adjustment. Is the risk adjustment adequate? If there are exclusions, are those exclusions justified either by the evidence, or if they're not clinical evidence-based exclusions, what's the analysis of what effect those exclusions have on the measure? And lastly, we have disparities, the measure being specified for disparities under 2C. We'll look at that after reliability and validity. We're still working with where that best fits, but the measure testing task force decision logic really applies to reliability and validity. Okay, so next slide. The measure testing guidance, the key points from the task force were, first of all, that reliability and validity should be demonstrated through empirical evidence, that it's not something that you say, we agree it's reliable or we agree it's valid, that it really should be demonstrated through empirical evidence. And the other thing to keep in mind is that reliability and validity are about the measure as specified, not about some concept in the literature. It really is a measure property, so it has to be the measure that is being presented is what was tested for reliability and validity. The task force really tried to provide flexible testing options rather than being prescriptive because there's a lot of factors that go into choosing a particular method. They did not set specific thresholds, again, because they thought that there are too many factors to have a hard and fast threshold of what the reliability statistic should be, for example. Here in testing, insufficient evidence basically means it wasn't tested. Perhaps it could be that they just didn't provide the information we needed and we can get that clarified. Again, we still need expertise and judgment to look at these. The task force also came up with some strategies to mitigate the burden of testing because they know that testing does require resources. So the rating scale is really based on allowing measured developers to test reliability and validity at either the data elements that go into constructing the measure or the precision of the measure score itself. So when we talk about of the data elements, we're really talking about the data that are captured and used in the measure. If it's a diagnosis, that's one part of a measure, that's one data element for a measure. Age might be a data element. Whether an intervention was provided is a data element versus the actual computed measure score, which might be the percent of patients who had X or percent of patients who died, et cetera. The task force did say that testing could be done on a sample and that if empirical evidence of validity of the data element was done, reliability of the data element at that level would not need to be addressed. And I know that this is a little very technical and complicated, but data element validity is really focused on, is it correct data? And so it's really comparing it to some authoritative source, whereas reliability of the data element is about repeatability, reproducibility. So if you're doing medical record abstraction and you compare results of two abstractors, that would be a reliability test. If you were looking at claims data and comparing it to what's in the medical record, that would be more of a validity testing. Is the information on the claims actually an accurate representation of the medical record? So we'll get into these nuances with some of the measures as we go through them. The other thing that, yes, go ahead.
I think this is a good time to ask this question. Several times I saw in my work that if it's electronically submitted data, that it's probably reliable, you know, and as you were just describing what reliability is, if it goes in and it's stored, it should come out the same way. But that there's still a burden to do validity testing and maybe some validity testing at the data element level. Is that
right? So if exactly. So the testing task force report did some work specifically on electronic health record data, which I think some of that also transfers to claims data. So if you have data in an electronic database and you apply your computer program, you're going to get the same answer. It's going to be repeatable. It's going to be reliable. But keep in mind that just because it's repeatable doesn't mean it was accurate or the right information in the first place. And so that's the difference between validity. And basically, if you're relying on data element level testing, there is a way to do some validity testing of electronic data as well. Lisa?
You know, I agree that it's an important standard. I just worry that if we're too stringent with it, it would mean that essentially all of our claims-based measures would have to be thrown out the window because, you know, depending on your perspective, I think claims are probably not that accurate, yet it's sort of the standard that we have today.
Well, I think that's the question that we're asking everyone to address. And the criteria actually allow face validity of the measure score. And so that's a pretty weak requirement. And we allow face validity if it's been systematically assessed, not just somebody says, you know, we agreed this was a valid representation. But, you know, it is a question that comes up is, are the data valid? And again, the task force guidance is to allow testing at either the data element or the measure score. So if people feel it's too burdensome to look at the data elements, then they're going to have to rely on hopefully doing some empirical validity testing, but currently our criteria allow for face validity. So there's multiple ways that people can address this, and they have to make the case first of all, to you as the steering committee, and then ultimately beyond this. So, we'll see some of that as you know with some of the measures that come up, and we'll kind of work our way through that. But the criteria apply equally to measures regardless of the data source. Reliability and validity are kind of basic principles of measurement that our task force and CSAC and board feel apply to all measures. Okay. The other thing is that prior evidence could be submitted. So, for example, on the claims question, this comes up probably more often, but if there was some study done that showed that claims for a particular diagnosis are highly reliable, we would certainly, the task force said, go ahead and submit that as evidence of reliability or validity for that particular data element. The other thing is that just in terms of the question about claims data, it may be known for certain diagnoses that claims data are highly valid and accurate versus other types of diagnoses or procedures. So, again, it's not an across-the-board. You can't make an across-the-board assumption. It depends on what you're trying to extract, what concepts you're measuring. Okay. And we will continue on. So reliability testing at the data element level, that the data elements are repeatable, producing the same results a high proportion of the time when assessed in the same population in the same time period, and or that the measure score is precise. So at the data element level, the key question is, has it been demonstrated that the data captured or used in the measure are repeatable and reproducible? And we've already talked about, you know, at the data element level, if you've done validity, then you don't have to do separate reliability. And at the measure score, has it been demonstrated that variability across entities is due to true difference or signal versus error or noise? So again, I think when we get into some specific measures, we can look at these examples a little bit better, but certainly if there are any questions, we can talk about those now. Yes.
I have a question, because many of the data elements, at least in those that I reviewed, were coming out of Crown Web. And if Crown Web doesn't have those data elements currently, it was very difficult to figure out how to evaluate those measures. The other concern I have is for those who are doing manual data entry, the inaccuracies of the data is pretty high. So how do we address that?
Right. Well, the CMS measures, they did test with actual Crown Web data. I know that there's a few other measures that were submitted saying that eventually those were going to be in Crown Web, and I think that's a discussion that you all will have to have. If they're not currently in Crown Web, so we don't have those specifications, you know, what would you be recommending for endorsement? So I think we just have to have a discussion about that, and perhaps we can, I know that's one of the questions we asked for clarification from some of the measure developers, and certainly they're all here to respond to questions as they come up from the committee. Okay.
Can I ask one more question? It has to do with reliability. Did I hear you say that measures or data that's collected using an electronic health record is reliable? And then, because I'm thinking of all the error that is involved with entry of that data and collection of that data before you have a score.
Right. And this gets into, so I think that points to the distinction between reliability and validity of the actual data. So reliability is about reproducibility. So if you have a software program that has been designed to pull the data used for the measure out of electronic health records, if you run that once and then run that again, you're going to get the same result. So it's reliable or repeatable. The key question is whether it's accurate, and that's the validity question. So is the data that's being pulled for this measure, is it an accurate reflection of the real data? So, for example, maybe it's pulling from the wrong field. But that's a validity question. And there are ways to look at validity of data from electronic health records. And again, it involves some comparison and abstraction. But I think that's, you know, if you keep in mind, at the data element level, reliability is about repeatability, reproducibility, versus validity is more about, is it the correct data? Is it the accurate reflection of the data? Okay. All right. Okay, so validity testing, again, could be done at the data element level, as we were just talking about, or at the measure score level. Has it been demonstrated that correct and accurate conclusions about quality can be made when we're talking about the measure score? And again, we do allow face validity. And again, we ask that they have something that somehow they've systematically assessed that, whether that's, you know, actually having a group of experts vote on that. Again, it's about the measure as specified. Will those scores actually reflect the level of quality in a particular facility? And we've actually, in some of the measures, we've seen really nice validity testing, looking at the conceptual relationships between a process measure and an associated outcome measure. And that's ultimately what we'd like to see, that if we measure performance on a particular process, how is that reflected in what we're actually trying to achieve with patients? Okay, so in your evaluation of testing, we ask you to consider, was an appropriate method used? And I know that this gets a little tricky, but, you know, we need to consider the level of testing, the data or score, what data source was used, the type of measure, the topic. I mean, there are a variety of things that go into selecting a method for reliability testing. We've asked on the submission form for developers to provide a rationale for that. In some cases, that wasn't provided, and it wasn't clear what was being submitted or why that was considered a test of reliability or validity. And we, pose those questions to the developers. I think everyone received all the responses we have, and I think some of that was cleared up. Was the scope of testing adequate? So if it's a sample, consider the number of measured entities, facilities, physicians, the number of patients, and the representativeness of who was included in that sample. And then ultimately, were the results that they obtained from their testing actually within norms or demonstrating that we have a reliable or valid measure? Okay, and I know I've gone over here, but I think it helps to get us kind of squared away here before we get into actual measures. So usability is the extent to which intended audiences can understand the results of the measure and are likely to find them useful for decision making. And we have a sub-criteria about public reporting and quality improvement. We, in this go-round, have really asked for a rationale, and occasionally measure developers have actually done some testing with their audiences on this, and of course if they have, that's great, and we ask for that information, but primarily I think you'll see a rationale in those sections. For, as I mentioned earlier, for endorsed measures, we actually would like to see that they're actually being used, and so we'll be looking at that as well. Feasibility, hopefully the data for clinical measures are actually data that are being used in providing care. Electronic sources of data certainly are less burdensome. Hopefully there's some discussion about potential susceptibility to inaccuracies or unintended consequences, and that the data collection strategy can be implemented. Related and competing measures, we're not going to address in our first go-through of the measures. This is something that we will look at the end of tomorrow. If we have related and competing measures, then we'll talk about how we're going to address those going forward. Okay, so I'm going to just quickly go through what we're going to do today at the meeting. We will have periods for NQF member and public comment twice each day. We're going to have the measure developers briefly introduce their measures at the beginning of each topic area. We ask the developers to really keep this to 2 to 3 minutes because they've presented the information to you in the measure submission about their measures. They're here and are available to respond to questions from the committee as needed. The steering committee will discuss and vote on each measure, and we'll do that by criteria. I'll be introducing the first measure, but we'll try to go through each criteria that we're going to ask you to vote on before we move on to the next one. That way, that discussion will be fresh. We can vote and then move on to the next one. Our process will be is to have one committee member begin the discussion. And we've asked you to summarize the preliminary evaluations, really identifying where there were questions, concerns, or differences of opinion so that we can really focus on the things that need to be discussed. And then we'll ask the other assigned reviewers to make if there are any additional comments and then have full committee discussion, followed by a voting on that particular criterion. As Helen mentioned earlier, and we handed out that four-pager kind of quick reference, if a measure does not pass importance to measure and report, we'll stop there. Same way, if it doesn't pass scientific acceptability, we'll stop there. Okay. And your votes today will really be conditional on whether there are related and competing measures. So we ask at the end, overall, has it met the criteria? But if there are related measures where there may be measure harmonization issues or competing measures, two measures basically on the same issue, the vote is not final until those issues are resolved. So it's, you know, this is kind of your preliminary. Okay. And I'll just, Lauren, you want to just mention the, we won't do the sample, but you want to just mention the electronic voting.
Everyone should have a remote control. Does anyone not have one? Okay, I just want to make sure we all have one. Just like before, once the criteria will be reflected on this screen here, and we will vote according to, we'll go through a sample. Once we go through the first measure, we'll just do a test to make sure all the remotes are working. And you also have a one-page instructional sheet. It should have been underneath your agenda. Just a quick instruction on how to use the remote, but fairly simple, and we'll go through a sample.
You're going to just go so.
Okay, you'll have up to 60 seconds to vote. Then you'll just press a number on the keypad that corresponds to the response that's on the screen there. You don't have to hit the send key. You can just do 1, 2, 3, et cetera. If you want to change your answer, you just change it to the number that you want to use, so 1 to 2, and you don't have to hit send after that. And then once after everyone has voted, we'll see the tally on the screen of the number of votes as well as the percentages.
Okay.
All right, and I believe you're ready for the first measure.
Okay. First we'll be starting with the anemia measures, and so we'll start with the
measure developer for 252, and I mean,
let's see, which I know, but who are they then? So CMS and CCPI. Okay, so how about CMS want to briefly present your measures?
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the committee for their time and their expertise.
Could you tell us who you are, just for the record?
The NCF organizers. I'm Bob Wolf. I'm with Arbor Research, which is the contractor for CMS. Actually, CMS is the measure steward and developer. I'd like to just say a few comments about the anemia measures that we have. There's one process measure having to do with ferritin and three target measures. And I wanted to say a bit about each one. The process measure we have for ferritin, there were questions about or issues perhaps related to performance gaps, which are correct. If you look at the data, you'll see that most facilities are performing quite well on this measure. We are coming into a time of bundling. It's very plausible that there will be incentive changes in practices, and I would ask the committee to consider that in thinking about whether performance gaps from the past are the only relevant issue in evaluating the importance of a measure. For the target measure having to do with hemoglobin levels, the level of evidence from clinical trials is relatively clear for hemoglobins greater than 12. There is very little evidence about hemoglobin levels less than 10 from the clinical trial data. but the hemoglobin less than 10 has been withdrawn by TMS, so that one isn't relevant. For some measures in general, I heard there were comments about the validity and reliability of the data. I would like to say that most, if not all, of the TMS measures that you will hear about during these 2 days are based upon facility-level measures. And while it's very valuable if every single patient's number can be reported correctly, in fact, at the facility level, with an adequate number of either patients and or time of follow-up, individual errors at the patient level are overcome because we're reporting an average. So it is really the reliability of the measure at the facility level that is important rather than only at the patient level. And again, I would ask the committee to consider that as you're thinking about the actual use of the measure. I know many doctors think about it at the patient level, and that's very important, but it is actually being used at the facility level where some inconsistency in reporting at the patient level can be overcome by data. Thank you very much.
PCPI also submitted anemia measures.
Sure, back here. Ed Jones. I'm a member of the kidney work group for the AMA PCPI, and along with Barbara Five-ish, we'll be representing that group as the developer of the measures. I'm going to really just get into the approach that we have for measure development and testing, and would rather leave the questions for the specific measures when they come up. The PCPI combined CKD work groups along with adult and pediatric ESRD groups in order to identify and define quality measures towards managing and improving outcomes for our patients. Two of the measures dealing with adequacy were previously endorsed by the NKF and therefore are up for review for maintenance. I want to point out specifically that all 8 of the measures have been tested for reliability and validity, and 7 of the 8 are being used in CMS's PQRS program. The measures were developed through a rigorous evidence-based process that has been refined and standardized for over a decade. Measures are developed through a cross-specialty, multidisciplinary group, including nephrologists from the RPA, ASPN, NKF, and ASPN, along with endocrinologists, methodologists, internists, preventive medicine, and family doctors. Practice guidelines are used as the foundation for the development of the performance measures, and the guidelines with the strongest recommendations are often the highest level of, and with the highest level of evidence are being used. The work group reviewed available information in gaps of care and unexplained variations in care to ensure that the measures represent areas most in need of performance improvement. The work group also reviewed data regarding feasibility, reliability, and exception reporting available from implementation of a subset of 2007 measures. The work group made every effort to harmonize these performance measures with similar metrics. It's important to recognize that outside stakeholders are involved, in particular those clinicians who will implement the measures. Therefore, all measures were released for 30-day public comment and were peer-reviewed. All comments were reviewed by the work group and were modifications were accepted as appropriate. The measures submitted for your consideration are specified to ensure widespread implementation using EHR when possible. In summary, the work group sought to focus on those areas with the most potential for impact, where there was the strongest consensus about the best practice, and where the likelihood of unintended harm was the lowest. Moreover, the group sought as much as possible to keep the measures straightforward, aligned when appropriate with measures developed by others, and clinically sensible, giving the clinician the latitude for judgment about the appropriateness of the intervention. And again, we'll address specifics of the measures during the question period. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, let's go with 262.
Okay. All right. So I just want to do one clarification, though, with Bob. CMS withdrew their hemoglobin target measures. So I just...
Thank you, and I said that very obliquely when I said that CMS had withdrawn them. So those, okay. I want to clarify that those are not CMS sponsored. Thank you.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So we're going to start with measure 0252, which is assessment of iron stores. And Lauren, would you bring up the... before we get into this measure, just want to mention that we can display information from the measure submission form if that's needed or any of the documents. And also we'll be looking at the tally of the preliminary results. So if, and I know that most of you brought your own files, but if you need something or you want something displayed, you know, certainly let us know. So what I will do is, you know, do a summary of the preliminary evaluations, and then we'll vote on each of the sub-criteria criteria that we need to as we go through them so that it's fresh in our minds. Okay. So with this measure, I will start with just a brief description. This is a measure of the percentage of all adults greater than or equal to 18-year-old hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis patients prescribed an ESA at any time during the study period or who have had a hemoglobin less than 11 in at least 1 month of the study period, for whom serum ferritin concentration and either percent transferrin saturation or reticulocyte hemoglobin content are measured at least once in a three-month period. For in-center hemodialysis patients, peritoneal dialysis patients, and home hemodialysis patients. So the other thing to note is this is a measure that's up for endorsement maintenance. It was endorsed in November of 2007. The other thing I want to note is that in our just now completing ESRD project, those of you who are on the committee, I just want to refresh your memory that we had two measures submitted on assessment of iron stores in the ESRD project, which this committee did not recommend go forward. So one of those measures submitted in the last project was intended to be a replacement for this one, and we can... talk about where I think they had removed measuring the reticulocyte hemoglobin content. But this is the measure that was endorsed. It's up for endorsement maintenance. I just wanted to remind people of where things were at with those last measures. And the primary reason that the measures were not recommended in the last project was the issue of assessment measures being distal to the desired outcome. And at that time, we actually had a measure of hemoglobin value. If you remember in that project for the pediatric and also in this project, initially we had an endorsed measure for hemoglobin values less than 10. And we'll get into this in a moment. I'm just trying to put the context with this measure. For the pediatric measure in the ESRD project, CMS at the end, even though that measure went through our whole process, withdrew that measure due to the recent FDA announcement that came out, and we provided all of that information to you all. So the pediatric hemoglobin less than 10 measure will not be endorsed, and CMS is also withdrawing their previously endorsed adult measure of hemoglobin less than 10. So I mentioned that because that was part of the issue of not endorsing an assessment measure about iron stores, because ultimately we had the hemoglobin value, and if there are problems with hemoglobin, one of the responses obviously is to look at iron stores. But I'll go on from there. I just wanted to kind of remind people of where we were with those measures. Okay, so the first sub-criterion that we asked you to vote on is on high impact, and basically the preliminary reviewers all agreed that this was either a high or moderate rating. So I'll just see if there's any additional comments or issues that anyone wants to bring up. Otherwise, we could actually vote on this sub-criterion and move on. So any issues about high-impact aspect of healthcare for iron stores in ESRD patients? Okay. So we didn't do a practice round with you, but we'll, for those of you who were here last time, you know, but want to remind you is that your vote will not register until it actually is a timer that starts. You'll have up to 60 seconds to enter your rating, and you'll be using a number between 1 and 4 for this.
Do you need to press send to get your vote to count?
No, you do not need to press send. And if you want to change your vote, you can change your vote before we stop the timer. And you would change your vote by just simply pressing another number. And that's all you would need to do. It will capture your last number. Once we know that everyone's vote is in, we will go ahead and stop the timer, and Lauren will be asking Christine and Lorian on the phone to give us their votes so Lauren can enter that.
Is Christine with us yet?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi. Hi. Okay.
Hi.
Do we need to have her do her introduction?
Yeah, I guess we should.
Yeah, and Andrew isn't here yet, is he? Dr. Narva?
No.
Okay. Christine, will you please do your introductions briefly, name, position, city you live in, a bit about your quality background. We've been giving one brief non-medical interest and then your disclosures.
Okay. I'm Christine Schonder. I'm a clinical pharmacist with the Sarcoma Transplant Institute in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My background with quality improvement is I've actually worked on all three of the renal committees here for the MQF and co-chaired the last steering committee with Peter as well. My non-medical interest, actually, I'm on the beach and away from all of you. That's why I'm not there, but I'm on vacation with my children. It's our first vacation since we've adopted two children from Russia. So sorry I couldn't be there with you, but you know, the beach is actually calling a little bit more right now. So, and as far as my disclosures, I do have no disclosures.
Okay, thank you, Christine. So we can go ahead with the...
Right, so unless anyone has anything to add or bring up about high impact...
Karen, can I just ask a quick question, Ms. Florian?
Yes.
The one through... What does that correspond to? I'm sorry I don't see that on the slide because I don't have a keypad.
We're voting on impact under importance to measure and report, and the options are high, moderate, low, or insufficient.
Right. So when polls, you can just respond on that
I'll just
scale.
I'll use answers instead of the 1 through 4. Is that okay?
I'm sorry, what?
So I can just respond as high, moderate, low, insufficient.
Yes, yes. Please use the words instead of the numbers so we make sure we're getting it correct. Right. The rating scale is also on the submission form and Excel file, et cetera. But, yes, definitely on the phone, just use the words high, moderate, low, or insufficient.
I think in terms of process, let's vote first, then we'll pull them. Okay.
Right. We want to do it actually.
Otherwise, they'll have undue influence on us.
Well, Lauren wants to be able to do it, enter their votes electronically. So we'll go ahead and start. I mean, it would be easier to ask them first, right?
You'd rather ask them first?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody don't listen. Okay. So,
Hi, this is Lauren. Lauren, I'm going to take your vote now for high impact. So high, moderate, low, or insufficient?
For impact, moderate.
Oh, yeah. Start the timer. And you can all vote now. Start the once the timer starts. Yes, you can do it simultaneously. Okay.
And then Christine, high, moderate?
Moderate.
Don't stop.
She only gave it 10 seconds.
So it's quick.
Okay, we're going to start over. We need to have 60 seconds.
Can I just ask a question to clarify here? When we're evaluating this, it's really on the importance of reporting as much or more than the importance of measuring. Measuring is just routine care, potentially, as opposed to the importance of reporting this publicly.
It's really both.
It's really the importance of the performance measure.
Right.
Itself. So not just routine clinical care, but the actual use of a measure for both quality improvement as well as accountability functions.
All right. So we're starting over on, no, it's. We could, why don't we, we'll see if this gets working. Otherwise, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll get this settled. Well, with the people on the phone, we're having trouble getting.
Can we just add them up at the end?
Yeah, we could add them at the end. Okay, let's take just a 10-minute break, a little bit early. We'll get this fixed, and then we'll be able to proceed more smoothly.
If you need to help for today, I can get somebody over here. Do you want me to get somebody over there to help today? It's supposed to be, I mean, it was flawless.
I don't know if this is the last part.
Well, do you want me to just call over somebody like,
Yes.
I do, as a matter of fact, right here. Check it out. New computer, it's looking at center where the thing out is. Come on. Astro. I don't know if that really matters. It's 10 seconds. No, right down there. Poll time says 10. Did you guys see poll time said 10? Poll time only said 10 on that prior slide. You have to change that. Thank you. figure it's easier. We have a table downstairs, yeah. So simple.
Okay.
Okay. Seems so tentative, I don't know.
Huh?
Not sure. I mean, the only time I've ever seen it truly flawless is when Lindsay did it. It was flawless. Two straight days. It never even, burped. It was just perfect. So.
Well, I think if no one uses it enough to know all the little intricacies, then...
She only used it once.
Huh?
She only used it once.
Well, I would say most people haven't used it enough.
Right, right.
And can't kind of
right.
understand
that's
the
right.
program and what's the...
Right. So she changes the 6 again every one of the 4.
Yeah. See what it is. And this is the issue from before. She says she didn't do this, but once you start a program, you have to set those timers so that it'll...